This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On the ABC Listen app.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you. In your town, your suburb.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
Have generational holiday homes become a luxury that Victoria can no longer afford? There's been yet another conversation this morning about locals not being able to find a permanent rental in their holiday town while holiday homes sit there empty. But isn't that the point of a holiday home? That it's there for you and your family during the holidays? The term holiday home, it's kind of become a dirty word, you know, a presumption of privilege. Or is it that there are now two types of holiday home owners and one is killing it for the other? There's the holiday home owner who sees the holiday home as a way to make money, a commodity, an income. And then there are those who have the classic Aussie holiday home, and it's been in their family for decades, for generations. It was built for next to nothing. There's bunk beds, basic furniture, maybe tents in the backyard over Christmas. So should those homes, if there's many of them left, should they be allowed to sit there empty, waiting for families to come down during the holidays? Or are those days gone too? And also this hour, when did recycling become our problem and not the companies producing the waste?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
We're going to Bonnie Doon.
Dad had a song he used to sing about going to Bonnie Doon, only he sang it a lot and it was a bit repetitive.
So are generational holiday homes disappearing, and does that matter? Again this morning, another conversation around locals in sea change areas not being able to get a long-term rental whilst holiday homes sit there empty. But are there two different types of holiday home owners? Are there those that see it as a business, see it as a way to make money? And are there generational holiday homes? So when I think holiday home, I don't think big fancy houses rented out as short stays that look like they belong in a magazine. I think of my late uncle. He built a two-bedroom fibro shack in Cowes in the 1970s. He even built the bunk beds in the bedroom. There was no phone, the furniture was mismatched, there was sand on the floor, and there were tents in the backyard. Now, he knew he was lucky to have this holiday home, but he also never went to Queensland. He never went overseas on his holiday. Every year, every holiday, for decades, he went to Cowes, and so did all of us. We all went down to this home. But fast forward to today, should that house sit there waiting for us in summer? Can Victoria afford for a family to have a holiday shack, to have a holiday home? Can the working class hold on to generational holiday homes? 1300 222 774. You can text as well, 0437 774 774. Are there two different types of holiday home owners? Has it become a dirty word? Hugo's in Point Lonsdale. Hi, Hugo.
Oh, look, good morning. I'm so glad I got to talk to you guys. We represent the classic fibro cement holiday home in Point Lonsdale. And yep. I'd love to just briefly tell you a little bit about it. Our family's had the holiday home in Lonnie for 70 years. That's 70 in the family. Mum bought the block of land for £600 with her dad's war pension money. And the house we relocated from one that was going to be demolished up the fancier end of town. The house was used by our family exactly as you've just described it. But more than that, it has been rented long-term over the decades, including to doctors, to vets, to people who were boat builders, to families who were homeschooling kids. And unfortunately, we are going to have to sell up because of the land tax. I've never stayed in Airbnb, and I think Airbnb, it's a whole different, it's a totally different conversation. And I know myself, having that house, when I would leave Melbourne, I was able to go down and run the local music festival or be involved in the community as a volunteer. And I feel that we've got cold beds. The Airbnb beds, they're a cold bed. You're going to go to the local pub and you're not going to meet locals.
The idea that there's sort of two different types of owners, but it's become really tricky to talk about. So there's texts like this, Hugo, and everyone, this is a safe space and want everyone to be able to talk openly and to talk to each other politely. So there's this text that says, it's pretty horrible to think that there are some people in our society who are happy to own more than one house when others can't even afford a place to live. How do we balance the idea that some can't afford it, but then some people do have the privilege of maybe having a generational holiday house? So I'm not talking about the money-making Airbnb short stays business type model. I'm talking about your family home. Are they a luxury that we just can't hold on to anymore, Hugo?
Well, they are because of the new land tax. So for us, it was $10,000, which means the house goes on the market this January. It'll be bulldozed or it'll be an Airbnb. And that's the reality. And no, I understand that the housing situation is desperate, but that's because we are not treating Airbnbs as a business, and they have become a monolithic business. Mm. And it's not comparable to say what happened to the taxi industry with rideshare. This is changing the fabric of these towns, and they end up the town is not that town anymore. And yeah, I'm lucky that I inherited the property, but I also would rather my parents didn't die. I can't be penalised for inheritance. and that was also the house my mum went and lived in, and before she went to the nursing home. So this little fibro cement shack near the beach, yeah, it's worth a lot of money, but I would never ever be selling it. And we wanted it to be something that my daughter would bring other families to, and that's the fabric of these towns. So I know it's not a simple cut and dry answer, but one of them is a commercial enterprise and the other one is what you described, the classic castle Bonnie Doon family holiday home. And I was able to maintain that until the land tax, and it's now pushes out us, those at the middle income, and what you'll be left is the top of the market. That's all you'll see.
Oh, Hugo, thank you. And I hope that you get to hold on to those memories. This text, my parents bought a beach house in the 80s. It was run down. It was the ugliest house in the street, not rented on Airbnb. We're always getting people asking us to buy it off us. We've spent every school holiday there. My parents never took us on a trip overseas or interstate or even to the country. So there are upsides and there are downsides. So many other friends and family members have benefited from it too over the years, getting free holidays and memories forever. I hope we never have to give it up. I'm in my 30s now and I'm trying to figure out a way that I can afford to buy it off my parents in the future. Are there two different types of holiday home owners? And when we talk about there being nowhere for locals to live in beach towns, whose responsibility is it? Angela's in Northcote. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
What did you want to say?
I think that you've kind of polarised the owners of beach houses. So for my husband and I, we have four children, and the idea of having the privilege of a family who are able to provide us with free accommodation over the summer is just unfathomable. So I feel like you've painted the people who have the generational holiday houses as Aussie battlers, but for us, we see that as privilege. And we have bought a beach house that we do have to Airbnb in the summer to be able to afford it, because we hope to be able to do the same things for our children, to give them what other people have had for generations. So there's also that middle ground there where we are using the house, and we are also bringing an income into the seaside town that we're in over the summer. But our goal isn't to make a profit. Our goal is to be able to provide our children and grandchildren with the things that those other people have had for generations.
So you can I get this clear, Angela? Sorry. So you have holiday homes that you rent out on Airbnb, and you do that so that you're
not homes. We have managed to scrape together, through great financial sacrifice, to buy one very modest home in, a very modest area of the coast, so that we can hopefully retire there as well and provide our children and grandchildren with those things that other people have had for generations.
Do you find it at the moment, Angela, given the situation that the state is in and the housing crisis that we're in, do you find it tricky to talk to people about the fact that you have a holiday home? Has it become a dirty word, whereas in the 70s it was kind of, it was celebrated?
The way I see it is that my part, it's not just up to people to make those sacrifices. We pay taxes for governments to manage the housing crisis. There are many ways that they can do that. And the way that I see it is my husband and I have literally worked since we were 12 years old. We've raised four children. I never had mat leave. We volunteered. We don't get any government benefits. I think it's okay for us to say, we worked really hard and this is one of the ways we provide for our family. And the government that we pay taxes to and vote in needs to take some responsibility in finding ways of housing people.
Angela, really good to get your thoughts. Thank you. Before we have a chat to Dr. Joy DeMoussi, let's have a chat to Lillian in Point Lonsdale again. Represent in Point Lonsdale today. Hi, Lillian.
Hi, how are you going?
Well, what did you want to say?
Oh, look, I'm in the same situation as a person who's got a family intergenerational home at Point Lonsdale. And the bill I got from the government this year was $11,400. For a property that used to cost me $1,800 a year in land tax. And it's not sustainable for people in my situation. The government has politicised people in my situation. There's not enough holiday homes in the whole of Victoria to fix the housing crisis, right? There's just not.
What about the idea, Lillian, it says, oh, woe is me. This is a text, right? And this is not me saying this. Woe is me, poor people with inherited privilege whinging about the land tax.
It's not about inherited privilege. If you're a single woman who's paid all their taxes and lives in the house and has lived in the house for 40 years, how is that inherited privilege? You know, people historically in this country, people have immigrated here to have a quality of life, which includes being able to have the freedom to make a decision to have a place outside of Melbourne if they chose to. And so my parents did that because that is where my family comes from. I'm sixth generation down there. So what is actually happening is the fabric of these communities, which has been in place for generations, is being destroyed. And people are being forced out of their home by government tax. Have a think about that.
I find it interesting too, Lillian.
It's a human right for everyone, not just some people.
And different people from different backgrounds, like culturally, you might have the fabric of a town. I know in Dalesford, I know Ella Wolftasker spoke about her heritage and buying a weekender down in that area, and then that sort of brought different people to that area as well. And do you stand to lose that? Lillian, thank you. It's a really tricky conversation to have, right? Because at the same time, there are people who don't have a home. This, when I first lived in Dramana from late 1967 to about 1978, three quarters of the homes were holiday homes. There was also one caravan park in Macrae, as well as in Rosebud, several caravan parks on the foreshore. Around Christmas, it would take 4 minutes before you could even cross the highway. Later, more and more Melburnians rented, and I suspect now that only a fifth to a quarter of Dramana houses and units are now not a main residence. That's from Davo. So we've seen that change. Joy DeMoussi, Professor of History and Dean of Arts at the Australian Catholic University. Joy, you've been listening to this, and I guess one of the things that comes through is how do you house people, but at the same time, how do you keep the history and the fabric of some of these towns when you're talking, like Lillian, sixth generation of people that have been in Point Lonsdale?
Yeah, it's a great question, Rochelle. It's a fantastic conversation this morning. Look, it's really interesting, isn't it? We are living through a very, very, very dynamic period of change, as we know, around housing and holiday housing and beach houses, as they used to call them. We still call them that, I suppose, are now in scope. I mean, you know, years ago, people wouldn't even blink an eye about their beach house or their shack by the river or whatever. But now, like all housing, it's becoming more and more difficult to afford a house, a getaway house, and as your callers have indicated there, to keep up with the taxes that have been imposed on maintaining and keeping a holiday home. So it's just part of the bigger equation about how housing has become the hot topic of the moment and becoming more and more difficult. And you've heard there are a whole host and range of complex and different views about this issue, but also different experiences like Hugo's story, very, very common Australian story about the family that went there and inherited and, you know, continued to go for decades and now can't afford it and will be selling. And what does that mean? And what does that mean for the future?
And I know your history, Joy, has looked into our migrant history as well. And there's a really strong migrant story to be told in a lot of these towns. How we view a weekender or a holiday home in Australia is probably very different to different parts of the world. And I could imagine there would be people from different backgrounds that have settled their holiday homes in different areas and whether or not that history will slowly be lost.
Well, that's absolutely right, Rochelle. And, you know, some of the areas that your callers have referred to have over the years attracted many migrant communities and many migrant groups who many years ago also bought a modest home as a getaway and so on and now are in a situation of, again, like your callers, you know, having to cover the tax and is it liable and so on. But there's a very rich migrant community and communities around the coast and rural areas of Victoria in the context you're talking about. It's really a massive change to what we're used to. And I think the question that many of your callers have raised is what is the future of some of these communities and what is the future of the concept of the holiday home, unless it is a very expensive one, which, you know, is out of reach for most people.
I think the shacks are going to go, Joy. I think that Aussie two-bedroom fibro shack tents in the backyard, I think that's something we'll be telling our grandkids about like it was a dream.
I think so. And, well, where are we going to be in 20 years' time? I mean, we may not even have some of these communities. They won't look like they do now and they're certainly probably not going to be seaside communities. They might be extended suburbs of Melbourne. I mean, you know, what is the future of the concept of the getaway and holiday home when housing is pushing and pushing and there's more and more pressure to develop these areas to build more houses? So I think you're right, Rochelle. It's going to be very interesting. It might be just a moment in time that we've been reflecting on and generationally, where's the next generation, the generation after that?
And I can't remember people or large amounts of people living in holiday towns permanently. I think that's something we've seen change throughout the pandemic as well. You know, I referenced my late uncle's house down in Cowes. There was the holiday community, but very few people lived there. However, people live there now. And so that's a different dynamic we have to pull apart.
Well, they do, and the whole working from home concept, right? Mm. So and the whole digital revolution that allows you to perhaps, you know, work in Melbourne, commute down to the coast, live down in the coastal area and so on. So there's been some really big changes in the workplace as well that allows for that to happen and for generations to see that as an option of where they might live rather than just go for their holidays.
Joy, always good to get your thoughts. Thank you.
Thanks, Rochelle.
See ya, Joy DeMoussy, Professor of History and Dean of Arts at the Australian Catholic University. Greg's in Windsor. G'day, Greg.
G'day, Rochelle. Look, just quickly, I think the answer is not to penalise the people that are already there and have been there for generations and are part of the community, even whether it be on a part-time or full-time basis. The answer is to let's have a different model and start to infill those areas by having, you know, like three-storey apartment blocks and cheaper housing. Bring people to those communities. Let's not by stealth destroy the communities that are already there.
And the when that text came in before, Greg, about all of the caravan parks that have gone as well, I think that will be like a story, a tale that we'll tell our children as well, when once upon a time there were multiple caravan parks in holiday towns that you would stay at and that you could stay at cheaply and afford and in an affordable way as well. They seem to be disappearing. Let's go back to Point Lonsdale. Everyone's listening in Point Lonsdale this morning. G'day, Barry.
Hello, Shell. How are you?
Good. What do you want to say?
Okay, look, we actually were lucky enough to buy a fibro shack a number of years ago now in Point Lonsdale. And I tell you what, when the furniture was taken out, my wife and I looked at each other and said, my God, what the hell have we done? It went from a shack to a cottage to it is now a house. We've extended the back. But the number of people that said, oh, you just got to get rid of that old thing. We wanted to try and keep something that was unique to the beach and to Point Lonsdale alive. So we are living there now. We moved down during COVID.
Oh, wow. Is it on stilts, Barry?
Pardon?
Is it on stilts?
No, it's not. Okay. No, it's not. It's not one of those double-story places. Okay. Listen, the other thing I wanted to say, and again, we're very lucky. We both are second marriage and managed to have a little bit of money, so we've got a place in the city as well, but it's small. But my whole thing about the housing crisis, and I know this is going to sound very socialist, but it's to do with the constant grabbing for profit, and I believe that is to do with, you know, the major corporations, that if we looked at it, you know, and this is the most difficult thing to do, to look at what's known as the circular economy, where we just have what we need, instead of you know, struggling for all this, you know, extra stuff that really has just become part of our society. So,
yeah. Oh, Barry, I do. I think about my uncle in the same way. He had this simple little fibro shack, but he never went to Queensland. He never went overseas. I mean, even the idea of holidaying overseas or interstate as a normal thing, that's something we've seen change in our lifetime. You know, that very few, only the fancy people that I knew growing up went overseas or went to Queensland. You know, things have just become very different. Full border calls on this, we'll try and get back to more of them a little later in the program. But something else we've been talking about today, and that is waste and recycling and just how many bins we've got. But when did waste become our problem? And why isn't it the problem of the people who generate the plastic, who make the waste? That's next.
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
We'll get back to more of your calls a little later on whether there are two different types of holiday home owners, generational and those that just see it as a money-making exercise. Does it matter if those small shacks disappear in your small coastal town? Is it more about letting people live there permanently? But if you're listening to Raphael Epstein this morning, you would have heard him talking about how many bins you have, how tricky it is to figure out where your waste goes and what gets done with it. But let's take a step back and start to think about, when did waste become our problem? And when did we have to think about navigating all of those bins outside of our home? Well, the burden of how we get rid of waste, it's actually really complex. And some argue that the plastics industry has shifted the responsibility of recycling onto us, the consumer. Dr. Jonathan Baker is a senior lecturer at the School of Business at the University of Adelaide. Jonathan, not a week goes by on this radio station where we don't talk about how broken our recycling system is, how confused we are about how many bins we have. Why is it our issue and not those who generate the waste in the first place?
Yeah, good morning, Rochelle. It's nice to be here. Very good questions. And I've just recently published a case study co-authored with Suvi Nenninen from Stockholm School of Economics on basically the history of how it is that waste and recycling has become an individual responsibility that is involves citizens, but also, of course, municipalities and collecting and sorting and dealing with this waste and recycling.
So, I mean, that obviously was a very strategic move. Was it to take the spotlight off the waste that they're producing in the first place, making it our responsibility to get rid of it?
Yeah, so it's an interesting historical case. It starts back in the 1950s in the United States. Vermont briefly banned disposable bottles because dairy farmers were complaining about broken glass being eaten by and killing livestock. And this small regulatory action basically frightened beverage and packaging firms in the US, and they responded in the same year by founding the nonprofit organization Keep America Beautiful. And at first, of course, this looked like a lovely civic partnership. It was a nonprofit organization funded by industry, and there were even conservation groups involved, like the Sierra Club. But by the 1970s, a number of these groups had pulled out because they realized that actually Keep America Beautiful was more focused on promoting industry goals, which was around making sure that litter and recycling was seen as a personal responsibility rather than sort of trying to tackle...
But that's what's happened here. So it works, right?
Yeah, and so then that same sort of messaging around the morality of litter bugs and so forth then transferred over to Australia. Keep South Australia Beautiful was established back in 1966, and then also that involved a glass manufacturer and a brewery. And I want to emphasize that I'm not criticizing these organizations as they exist today. I'm just talking about the history and what we see. And then, of course, Keep Australia Beautiful became the national campaign, and then slogans like Dopes, Rubbish, Australia and This Little Pig ads became very widespread in the 70s and 80s.
The idea that it's our responsibility once we purchase it, but it's our fault because we purchased it in the first place and it had plastic and we knew what we were doing. When it comes to, well, is it our responsibility because we purchased the veggies that now all seem to be wrapped in plastic for whatever reason? It doesn't feel like we're progressing in any way. Is it kind of our responsibility because we've purchased it?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really important here that we do take a very systemic view of how to assemble some sort of structural solution to these problems. Of course, all of us as consumers are individually responsible. We need to keep recycling the things that genuinely work, some types of plastics, glass and aluminium, paper and so forth. But we also need to look out as well broader into the broader system and think, okay, so what are the things we can do to actually really improve rates of recycling, recovery, reduce environmental damage and so forth?
It's getting to the point where we are so greenwashed, you know, symbols on plastic. We don't even know if that means they've recycled it, we have to recycle it, or if you, you know, put it on your head and turn around three times, it can be recycled one day eventually in some fashion. Mm. No one really knows what to do anymore. Like, how did it get this complicated, and how much of that responsibility should be on local councils or on government to just put a line, draw a line in the sand and say, okay, you can't use this stuff anymore?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, you know, if we take the systemic perspective, there's definitely regulatory measures that can be put in place. You know, if we look at somewhere like Europe, they have very, very effective container deposit schemes there. We also have them here in Australia, of course, which is great, but in Europe, they're recovering more than 90% of bottles and cans as opposed to about 65% here in Australia. Mm. So the way that they've created that system in Europe is that they've got these very sophisticated extended producer responsibility laws. And these make not just producers but also retailers forced to share the cost of collection.
Yeah, well, there's a text here saying in Germany that's the case. In Germany, cardboard recollection of packaging is the responsibility of the retailers.
Mm. So if you go to a German supermarket, you'll see that they have reverse vending machines where you basically drop your bottles into the machine. It will then give you a credit that you can use on your supermarket shop. So you get this deposit back instantly.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's forcing the retailers to be, as the distributors of this waste, to also take the responsibility as well. So really trying to shift that. Of course, all of us as consumers still take the individual responsibility of engaging with these machines, but producers and retailers are also involved as well.
It's interesting. Simon sends this message. It says, this is a great topic. Thank you. I've thought for a while that manufacturers should be paying for landfill and recycling, maybe including an algorithm for expected lifespan of everything so that we're encouraging the development of items that last a long time and that aren't overly packaged. It keeps tips free so that people don't dump rubbish in the bush or on roadsides. I mean, Simon's touched on so many different things there that we could talk about each of them for an hour within themselves. But fundamentally, it comes back to putting some responsibility onto the manufacturer.
Yeah, I think the manufacturers, the retailers as distributors, and continued responsibility for us as individual citizens as well around limiting our uses of plastics, but also being responsible for returning it back into the system.
Yeah.
Of course, another important thing I think that needs to be mentioned too is virgin plastic production, which is made from oil, and it remains cheaper to produce than recycled plastic.
So we do much of that here?
Well, I think it's another important regulatory intervention that needs to be made around making incentivizing recycled markets to be really successful while limiting virgin plastic production.
We just don't do that, though. We just seem to bring more bins in for our own personal homes. Like, quite seriously, if there are other alternatives, is it because they're too expensive or too hard for government to tackle, or they don't care? Or should it be council? Should councils, do they have the freedom to go out on their own if they want to?
I'm not sure if councils can go out on their own or not. Whether or not they could get the kinds of economies of scale you'd require to do that successfully, I'm not sure. But certainly I think we've got to be cognizant of the fact, and the case study that I published reflects this, is that industry lobbying and industry associations are very, very powerful beasts, and over long periods of time can work really well at trying to maintain profitability for their members.
Really good to get your thoughts on this, Jonathan. Thank you. It's something we discuss at length a lot, and rightly so. Dr. Jonathan Baker is a senior lecturer in the School of Business at the University of Adelaide, talking about when waste became our problem and whether or not it should be our problem and it should be the problem of the manufacturer. Coming up in just a moment, Christmas adverts. Why do some really pull at our heartstrings? And have you found yourself tearing up at a Christmas advert? And why is that?
This is where the conversation begins.
The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt.
So Christmas advertising, why do some hit us harder than others? Is it because at this time of the year we're just emotional, easy targets? So the latest UK-based ad, and it's for a shop called John Lewis, their Christmas advert targets Gen X with music and a real club banger. So this ad's gone viral. You might have seen it. And the focus is all about how quickly life just passes us by. We're no longer hitting nightclubs. Our teenagers are pulling away from us. We're thinking back to when they were babies and just how quickly they grew up. Now, this ad is everywhere. People are talking about how they've connected to it so much and how so many of us have even teared up when we've seen it. Yet for many of us, we don't even know the store. So why is it? Dr. Paul Harrison, Director of Masters of Business Administration Program at Deakin University. Paul, this is an ad for John Lewis. I think they're quite well known for their Christmas adverts. I have to admit, I got a little teary watching it, and I've never even heard of the store.
Yeah, and it says a lot. And I think John Lewis are very famous for this, as you say, Rochelle. I think what they do is that they give you little mini movies about something, and their big kind of focus is on things like nostalgia, emotionally kind of resonant stories that can be told in a 2-minute kind of sequence. And I think one of the things that they've done really well, and they use a whole range of different kind of emotional triggers, things like images, even the colouring that they use in the ads, the music that they use, all of these things tap into what we call mirror neurons. And what mirror neurons are these things that happen in our brain that actually make us feel as if we can relate to that person, to that experience. And it's actually a useful thing because humans are storytellers. And so what we do is that we attach our story to this type of activity or this ad itself.
And at Christmas, we're just more emotional than ever. So are we easy targets?
Yeah, we are. I think this is the thing that people don't fully understand about emotions is that ultimately what happens is all emotions are not felt as in as good or bad. It's a form of arousal. And what we then do is we attach what's called valence to it. And what that means is that we interpret the emotional surge, that whatever that is, that arousal, and we interpret that through our own experiences. And so we take those raw sensations, we attach it to memory, we attach it to experience, and then we work out how we want to feel. And this is all happening, you know, incredibly fast. And so if, say, for example, if Christmas, you know, if you have this nostalgic feeling about Christmas or you feel like you've lost contact with or connection with your teenager or something like that, there's a feeling that is kind of a little bit painful but also a little bit hopeful. And what happens is that the brain then interprets this and says, this is how you have you've got this kind of arousal happening in your body. You cry or you respond, and then we attach meaning to it. This is why we cry when we hear music, you know, and we go, why am I crying? It's beautiful. And I think it's the same thing. It's kind of like we've attached crying to negative experiences, but crying can also be a positive experience. And I think this is what's happening when we see these types of ads.
It's like there's a Qantas ad around Christmas time a few years ago. And for many of us, you know, we despise airlines, and yet the use of music, that connection to family, missing people, the time of the year where we're all exhausted and tired and looking forward to a break, and it holds on to that emotions. I feel like Gen X are really prime targets. for this year as well, that sandwich generation.
Yeah, and I think also we are, because I'm Gen X, we are in that stage where we're trying to interpret our role in the world to some degree. Now, it's not, you know, midlife crisis, but it's going, what is our role now that our kids are growing up? What is our role in this world? And I think we're kind of moving towards, you know, the not necessarily the end, but the kind of end of part of our identity, and it is getting us to question these things. It's very clever, and it's tapping into, I guess the thing is, again, is that emotions drive behaviour, and we've talked about this a lot, Rochelle, is that it's not rational decision-making, it's how we're feeling. And what John Lewis are able to do is attach an emotional response, an emotional schema or scheme to the brand. It doesn't mean that we're going to go out and buy something from them, but we feel warmer about them. We can recall the brand much more easily. We trust it. Therefore, as a kind of default signal, basically we are more willing to go to this particular brand. And that's why you don't see things like, you know, now for $4 you're going to buy this thing.
Well, that's it. They're not selling you anything as such other than you liking the brand. I wonder, Paul, I mean, for some bigger brands, is Christmas their Super Bowl when it comes to advertising and this is our time to get you in and win you over?
I think so. And I think it is one of these, I guess you've got to be cautious about this. Your brand already has to have some degree of awareness and people's understanding of it. So again, you know, like I think the thing is that if we're talking about, say, airlines, for example, Qantas and things like that, the reason it works for people is not because it's Qantas, but because people attach memories to travel. They attach memories to maybe a previous past with when Qantas was providing amazing service or this belief system. But again, we don't memorize or we don't remember things chronologically. We remember the emotions that we had. And I think a really good example of this is, you know, when we have memories of going to the beach as a kid or even as a teenager, we remember not the messiness or the reality, the hot work, you know, the hot sand and stuff getting in our crack and all of that kind of stuff. It is actually what we remember is the emotional experience. And for some people, it might have been not a positive experience. Mm. And so that's why people they're not necessarily drawn to the beach in that particular way.
I find it fascinating that for whatever reason, some Christmas adverts cut through get teary, go viral, and others we just turn our back on. Paul, good to speak with you. Thank you.
Cheers, Rochelle.
See you. Dr. Paul Harrison, Director of the Masters of Business Administration Program at Deakin University. My name's Rochelle. This is The Conversation Hour. You're on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. If you've just joined us, we've been talking about a couple of things. We've been talking about recycling and when did it become our problem. This, hi Rochelle, our problem? Yes, it's our problem. We don't have to buy crunchy packets of apples. You can still buy fruit and vegetables loose, except for berries, unfortunately. We do have a choice of not buying the rubbish from the shelves. So should it be our responsibility to recycle, or should it be the responsibility of the manufacturers not to produce the plastic? Jenny's in Dramana. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Rochelle. Look, I just wanted to say, having picked up rubbish for a long time, mainly on the beach and foreshore, what strikes me is the manufacturers have got their name all over most of this stuff. So I see it as advertising. It's their advertising. So it's their problem. They're the ones that have left their advertising material all over our environment. Mm. And it's time for them to come and pick it up.
Jenny, the other thing we've been talking about this morning is, I guess, the loss of generational holiday homes, the old fibro beach shack. Yes. You're in Dramana. Are they disappearing?
Oh, for sure, yeah. And it's reflected in the prices. But I live where there's a bit of a view, and I'm the one remaining fibro house in the street.
Wow.
And multi-million dollar prices. So yeah, there's something very wrong with how our housing economy is going, isn't there?
Does it matter if the fibro shacks disappear? Does people earlier were talking about the fabric of Dramana. Will that be lost?
Well, it's looking like it to me, who's been here all my life, and the planning scheme, I think, still has a clause in it about retaining neighbourhood character. Well, we can't be retaining neighbourhood character if we keep smashing it down and putting up McMansions covered in pink Alucobond.
Good to hear from you, Jenny. Thank you. Enjoy the sunshine down there. It must be beautiful there today. Kathleen's in Geelong. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So holiday homes, the old school generational shacks, are they going to be a thing of the past? Does it matter?
Oh, I think it matters. I think these. I think we need. There's something really wrong with our system that people can own two or three homes in a little country town where locals can't afford to buy back in, and they're just all Airbnbs.
Mm.
Also, own one down on the beach, and then on the Sunshine Coast. You know, when you've got people owning five holiday homes, there's something wrong with our system.
How would you fix it, Kathleen?
I'd look at how it's all taxed. I think they should be taxed. You know, like more homes that you own, the higher tax that you pay. So if you got just one holiday house or one house, extra house, you pay say 15% more. If you got two, you pay 20% more. If you have got three, you pay 30% more. I think people should be paying for their greed, should be paying the taxes for it.
Good to get your ideas, Kathleen. Thank you. We'll try and get back to more of your calls in just a tick. The number's 1-300-222-774. So I don't know about you, but I am terrible at remembering names, which is, you know, slightly terrible given what I do for a living, but I'm also really bad at remembering people's faces and where I know them from. I always turn to my family and say, I know that person from somewhere. And it turns out that they're super famous and, you know, I think that it's someone that I know, and it's not. But according to new research, there is a particular way to remember people's faces. So I wonder if this is something that can be learnt. Maybe there's hope for me still. Dr. James Dunn is a research fellow and lecturer at the School of Psychology at the University of New South Wales. James, are some of us just good at remembering people's faces and some of us are just terrible?
That's right. We see face recognition as an ability, sort of like intelligence is. We have a variability across people. But some people are naturally born very, very good at remembering faces, and we have a term for those people. They're called super recognizers. And at the other end, we have people who are having problems recognizing even their friends and family. They're face blind and have a disorder known as prosopagnosia. And most people fit somewhere in between those extremes.
I know the extreme. Dr. Carl, who many of us know here on this station, I interviewed him at length about that last condition that I can't pronounce that you just pronounced beautifully, James. And he lives with that, where he can't recognise faces, even of his own daughter, for example, and he uses other triggers to be able to remember it. So it might be shapes, it might be smells. He asks colleagues to sit in the same seats. So he uses other things other than somebody's face to be able to recognise them, which is bizarre to wrap your head around.
That's right. It's something we take for granted, is how easily we are able to do this ability to recognise people. And even for people we know quite well, we're doing it when they've changed their appearance quite a bit, or when we see younger photos of them, or when we see them in a few years' time. We're still able to recognise people even through dramatic change. It's quite an impressive ability, even for the average person.
So what did your research look at? It looked at the super recognisers and how we can then take that information and use it?
That's right. So we've done some research on trying to understand what makes super recognizers so super at recognizing faces. What is the key to their ability? And one of the questions we asked that is it the way that they look at faces that is different? Do they pay attention to different parts of the face? And so we've run a few studies now where we've investigated this using eye tracking technology, records how the eyes move when looking at photographs or people standing in front of them. And one of the things that stood out to us was that super recognizers aren't cluing in on just one particular feature. It's not like they're just, all I do is look at the eyes, but actually they tend to move their eyes across the other people's faces more. They're exploring the face. And I think what we've uncovered is that they're cluing into what is the distinguishing features of that person. So if we imagine every single person has something about their face which is slightly different to the average, what we consider average, slightly abnormal or more distinguishing feature. So for example, if we look at King Charles, he has slightly larger ears and nose, and that would be his distinguishing feature. And we think what they're doing is cluing into the unique distinguishing features of the faces that they see.
Can you learn it? Can I get better? Is there hope for me still, James?
Unfortunately, all our research sort of indicates that this face recognition ability seems to be largely tied to our genes. So it's something that's been coded in our DNA. So although we've seen this pattern in super recognizers about how they move their eyes, there's no evidence to suggest we can train anybody to do the same thing, or at least nothing we've been able to show in the lab.
Wow.
We're still working on that problem.
I come from a long line of bad recognizers, is what you're saying.
Yes, unfortunately, if you are not good at recognizing faces, or if you are, the person to blame is your parents.
Yeah, okay, excellent. Well, I blame them for everything anyhow, so we'll just add that to the list. And when we look at how technology uses facial recognition, is there any connection between how the human recognizes a face and how machines, AI, recognize faces?
So the important thing to understand about the state of the art in facial recognition is that the way these computer systems are designed is actually modeled on the structure of the brain. So the type of technology behind most modern facial recognition is called neural networks. And they're called that because they simulate the way our brain has neurons connecting between different parts and areas and different layers. And so these neural networks in these AI models are being trained to do different tasks. In the case of face recognition, they're shown millions or even thousands or even millions of photographs of people, and they say, learn how to distinguish between these different people. And it turns out when you get AI to do that, solve that problem, it comes at it in a slightly different way to how humans do it. And that might be because of the resources available to it. So an AI system can look at all the pixels of the photograph all at once. Whereas as humans, we have a bit more of a constrained attention. We can only focus on parts of information at a time. And so we solve the problem in a slightly different way.
Wow. I find it incredible that you're actually born a super recogniser, and no matter, so I'm just going to give up. If I don't remember you, what you look like or your name or your face, don't blame me, blame my parents. So at least I feel a bit better about that. James, thank you. It's really interesting. Dr. James Dunn, Research Fellow and Lecturer in the School of Psychology at the University of New South Wales. If you've just joined us at the beginning of the program, we were talking about the generational holiday home. If you had a parent or a grandparent who built a holiday home in the 70s, that's where you spent all of your holidays. You know, the little fibro shacks with mismatched furniture and no telephones. Are they now a privilege that this state can no longer afford? Should we be able to hold on to them if that's something that's been handed down to you? This text, holiday home owners contribute nothing to the ongoing functioning of the local economy. And this from Sally in Gippsland, people of low economic income are never going to be able to afford holiday houses at the beach. But Sally, in the 70s, we could, right? My uncle was from a low socioeconomic home and he was able to build one and afford one in the 70s. I agree that now that's not a possibility, but it's about whether or not that home should be able to stay in the family or whether it should be given back to the community, so to speak. Steve's in the city. G'day, Steve.
Hi, just a couple of points. There's two ways. There's generational wealth, and then there's wealth that you build yourself. And I myself come from a background where I got kicked out of school, but I've worked hard to build my wealth. I've worked hard to buy houses. I listen to the ABC from 4 o'clock of the morning till 2 o'clock of an afternoon, and I continue to hear people harassing the government for taxing us. Now I hear the people turning on the people that have worked hard, saying tax us more for our hard work.
There's a text, Steve, that says the exact same thing. It says, I own five properties and I've worked hard to achieve this.
Yes, I've worked very, very hard to achieve what I have. And if I make a decision in a democratic society where I can make a choice to turn it into a business in Airbnb, I do contribute. I pay taxes, I pay, and I bring people to the place. Change is what people hate. It's the biggest thing that we struggle with as human beings, that things have to change.
And it's also emotional when we're talking about homes. But, I mean, given that, again, today, I mean, I've lost track of the amount of times we've spoken about locals in so-called holiday towns where locals have nowhere to rent long-term. But, you know, how many people should be living in holiday towns? Is that town set up for permanent residents? And then what happens if we lose all of these fibro shacks, all of these generational holiday houses? Will they become a thing of the past? And does that even matter? Are we just kind of holding on to nostalgia, to an old school Aussie holiday experience that we had that unfortunately may not get passed on down the line because people need somewhere to live? I won't be here tomorrow. Justin Smith will be filling in, but I'll speak to you on Monday. Take care. Speak soon.